Okay, everything's switched on. We're in Philippians. Again, we've spent several weeks so far in the book of Philippians now. We started off looking in Acts 16. And we noticed in Acts 16 that the Philippians, the people in Philippi, saw themselves as Romans. They said, "We are men of Rome." And that made a big difference to how they thought of themselves, the citizens of Philippi. And then in the second week, in verses 1 to 11, we zoomed in on Paul's prayer that these believers in this church in Philippi, in this new church that's been formed, that their agape love, their selfless love, their sacrificial love, would abound more and more and more. And then last week we looked at verses 12 to 26 of chapter 1, and all the things that you might think are roadblocks for Paul, he says, no, they're not roadblocks at all, they're actually stepping stones, and God's kingdom is being built all along. Now tonight we're looking at verses 27 through to 30, so just a few verses for us to think about tonight. Chapter 1, verse 27 to 30. Now, if you're a British citizen, and you have been a British citizen all of your life, which I suspect is the case of many of us here tonight, you may not have thought about your citizenship very much. But actually, the fact that you are a British citizen gives you lots of rights. And you were just born with these rights by virtue of being born as a British citizen. You have the right to live in Britain. Not everyone does, but you do because you're a citizen. You have the right to seek justice through the British courts. You have the right to be treated fairly, not discriminated against. You have employment rights. You have the right to certain information that companies hold against you, and so on. We could make long lists of all the rights you have. But we don't tend to think about our citizenship very much. But for some people, it's really important. If you're someone who has applied for British citizenship, and you had that day when you were successful, and you went along and you had this ceremony where you pledged an oath, an allegiance of loyalty to the British state and so on, then actually for you, that's probably one of the most exciting days of your life. People are thrilled when they become British citizens. If you become a citizen of another country, you get citizenship in a way that I don't think you do otherwise. And the people living in Philippi appreciated the value of being a citizen. And that's because they were Roman citizens, and there was a sense of pride that came with that. They'd been appointed, they'd been told that everyone in Philippi was entitled to be a Roman citizen. Philippi was where army veterans of the Roman army went to retire. And it meant, the fact that you were a Roman citizen meant you had all sorts of rights. It meant you had the right to not pay certain taxes. Things like poll tax, you were exempt from it. It meant you had the right to a fair trial, to appear before a proper court and defend yourself. But you didn't have that if you weren't a Roman citizen. It meant you had the right not to be tortured or whipped or beaten. It meant if you were sentenced to death, you couldn't be put on a cross. It meant, and I do this in inverted commas, it meant you had the right to be beheaded as your method of execution instead of being crucified. The idea is, if you want to know, if you want the details, it was that it was so much quicker. Painless. Quick. Just one shot. Anyway, that's enough. I'll carry on. Various privileges of being a Roman citizen. But along with that came responsibilities. And again, the people in Philippi, they just would have got that. They understood what that meant. It meant that if you were under attack, you fought. So the Roman army regularly throughout history conscripted men into the army. You had to join. And the people of Philippi are living in an area steeped in military history, not just the Roman army. This is the place of Macedonia, where Alexander the Great hailed from. They got this idea of, well, if your country goes to war, you stand up and fight. That's what being a citizen is all about. Now, it's not surprising then that Paul picks up on this metaphor of citizenship in verses 27 to 30. But when you look at your Bible in front of you, you might be thinking, hang on, I can't see that word anywhere. And you'd be right that the concept of that is just something that's been lost in the English translation. And it says in verse 27, only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ. And the word there for conduct is a word that specifically refers to your conduct as a citizen. How you behave in society, how you live as a citizen. But there's a particular type of citizenship Paul has in mind, and in fact he refers to it a couple of chapters on. In chapter 3, verse 20, he says, our citizenship is in heaven. It's that citizenship that Paul is talking about in these verses, being a citizen of the kingdom of God. A citizenship means being part of a country. I guess that goes without saying, part of a kingdom. And as I said already, that means you fight for your country. And the military picture is one that comes through all the way through these verses. Because it's not just the army that fights, is it? Think about the world wars that our country has gone through in the last century. Well, it wasn't just the army that fought. Britain is at war. Every man and woman was to do their duty, even if it was, you know, growing vegetables in your garden. You did your bit. We were at war. Every single man and woman was involved in the fight. And this picture of fighting as citizens comes through these verses. So just picking them out, just to show you what I mean, he talks about standing fast in verse 27. Picture of standing firm, an army illusion there. He talks about striving together. Again, wrestling, battling, fighting, the military picture. He talks about the adversary, the opponents, the people you're fighting against. He talks about suffering. Suffering's a regular part of war, isn't it? Verse 30, he talks about conflict. These are all fighting terms. He wants these Christians who are citizens of the kingdom of heaven to know that they're in a battle. That being a citizen means we've got to be ready to fight. Now, before we look any further, let's start by thinking about who the adversaries are. They're mentioned in verse 28. He says that they mustn't be terrified of their adversaries. Who is it he's talking about? I think the most likely answer, if you flick over just a page or so to chapter 3, you see he talks in those opening verses. Chapter 3, verse 2 says, beware of dogs and evil workers. He says, beware of the mutilation. And then he says, verse 3, for we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit. He's talking here about people who champion the law of Moses, people who insist on circumcision as a badge of salvation. That's what he's referring to when he talks about the mutilation. He's literally referring to people who cut the skin, people who circumcise and insist on circumcision as a sign of being saved. So although Philippi is a Roman colony, and there's mainly Gentiles there, there are clearly people there as well who are saying you must be circumcised to be saved. Now, do you know, when you read through the New Testament and you read Paul's letters, what you notice is that this is the big battle the Apostle Paul is going to fight. The one big thing is he's fighting people who say you must obey the Old Testament law and all its rules and regulations, like being circumcised, in order to be saved. You say, well, isn't, you know, what's the big deal, Paul? It's just a cut in the skin. It's just a tradition, after all. What's the problem? But for Paul, the gospel itself is at stake. For Paul, it means if you have to be circumcised to be saved, then it's not just by faith alone. It means you have to do something. It means something physical has to take place for you to enter the kingdom and become a citizen of heaven. Those, I think, are the adversaries that he's talking about in this verse. So verse 27, Paul's saying, he talks about how they're to strive together for the faith of the gospel. Now, when he talks about the faith of the gospel, I think what he most likely has in mind are the essential truths, the key beliefs of the Christian faith. Things like being justified by faith alone. They're going to have to fight for the Bible's message, because otherwise it's going to be lost. And you know, that's a battle that every generation of Christians has to fight. Now, the issue itself will change, because we don't hear many people today saying you must be circumcised to be saved. That territory has been won, but it just means the battle moves on to a different place. Where are those battles for doctrines like that being fought today? Well, we could probably list lots of them. If we went round the room, we'd probably all think of different key truths from the Bible that are being challenged and fought against today. You can certainly still see it in the Roman Catholic Church that does say faith and good behaviour is needed to go to heaven. I read recently about a Church of England. The Church of England has appointed a new Anglican ambassador to Rome, to the Church of Rome, to the Pope. And the man they've appointed denies the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ. Children, if you're wondering what that means, this is a man who is a leader of a church, and he's saying Jesus didn't actually rise from the dead, that it's just a nice picture for us to imagine, but he didn't actually, in time and space, physically rise from the dead. Well, I know what Paul would say about that. Paul says if Christ didn't rise from the dead, then we of all people are most miserable, most without hope, because without the resurrection, everything falls apart. It's a battleground in Paul's day, and it's a battleground for us again. Being a citizen of God's kingdom means recognising there is a war to be fought, a war for truth, a war for the purity of the gospel message. So how are we going to fight? This is a battle that we're all engaged in. It's not just for the specialists, for the SAS, it's for all of us. And I want to give you three ways from these verses that Paul says we, as citizens of the kingdom of heaven, are to fight. Firstly, verse 27, he says we're to fight together. Now remember that Paul's writing from prison. So he says in verse 27, when he says that, whether I come and see you or am absent, he doesn't know if he's going to live or die. So he doesn't know if he's going to see these people face to face again. Or maybe he's just going to hear. He says, I may hear of your affairs. He may just hear reports, things that have been going on in the church in Philippi. Either way, whether he's present or not, he says there to stand fast in one spirit with one mind. See, the same thing he's saying again and again. Stick together, one spirit, one mind, united for the faith of the gospel. Now you read those words, though, I think you can imagine these Christians in Philippi saying, well, hang on, defend the truth of the gospel. Isn't that your job, Paul? Isn't that why you've been appointed to be an apostle? And Paul would say, yes. And then I think they could say, and isn't that the job of the elders of the church? And say, yes, it is. But it's also the job of every church member to defend the purity of the gospel message. A stand fast. You can see the army picture he's using there. The Roman army were experts at not retreating. You stand your ground. The attack might be fierce. The enemy might be firing all sorts of things at you. But they would stand firm. They'd have their formation with their shields that they'd hold up, and they'd withstand the attacks. Because they knew, once you start giving ground, once you start turning and running, well, the enemy can just charge at you. They've got one on you. But if you stand firm, they'll lose their nerve. That's the picture when he says, stand fast. And then it's the same when he goes on, when he says, in one spirit with one mind, striving together. Well, you might have, if you have a different translation, you might have striving side by side. This is a word used for athletes. But when I say athletes, don't think Usain Bolt running down a track. Think of gladiators. And when I say gladiators, don't think of the 1990s TV programme with John Fashanu and Ulrika Johnson, if that means anything to you if you're of a certain age. Don't think of those gladiators. Think of Roman gladiators who would go in, sometimes in teams, fighting together, fighting for their lives. Their own lives were at stake. That's what it meant for those gladiators to fight side by side in the arena. So this, all of this is going to bring to mind the pictures of the Roman army. That the army was so well drilled in moving forwards and backwards as a unit. Because, you know, actually there was a great safety in that. As brilliant a fighter as you might have been, if you launch an attack against the enemy by yourself, or if you get scared and run off by yourself, you're in trouble. But if you stick together, all those shields forming a defensive barrier that was just impenetrable. Any other way you're going to get picked up. But actually the strength is in it being a team effort, in fighting together. Paul says, stand fast in one spirit with one mind. One mind just means that. It means just that. It means you're thinking the same way. It means you're working towards the same thing. So I'm thinking, okay, that's fine, but what's my role in all this? Because maybe you're not involved in teaching. You're not someone who comes and stands up at the front and preaches. So how am I supposed to be involved in defending and maintaining the purity of the gospel message in this church? Well, let me give you one way. We could give others, but here's one thing. What would you do? What would you do if tonight I stood here in the pulpit and I said, do you know what? That Anglican ambassador is right. Jesus didn't physically rise from the dead. It just didn't happen. What would you do? What would you do? I hope you would act, because it would be the right thing to do, to challenge me in the right way. You know, giving the benefit of the doubt, maybe I didn't mean what I said, but you know what? You need to act. You can't have someone in the pulpit saying what is heresy, what is wrong, and what is going to destroy the gospel, because the gospel is so much bigger and more important than any preacher or any pastor. It's one of the reasons I encourage you, as I'm preaching, have the Bible open in front of you. I don't mean that, but I'm not saying be suspicious of me or whoever's standing in the pulpit. I'm not encouraging suspicion, but I am encouraging having a mindset that says the gospel matters, so we're having open Bibles, checking, is what's being said and taught, does it come from the Bible? Is it true? The church must act when the truth is not being preached from its pulpit. And church members have a responsibility with that. In fact, if it came to it, members need to remove pastors from their position. That has to happen in churches sometimes, because you can't have pastors who no longer believe the gospel still standing at the front preaching. And that actually comes down to the church members to act. Well, we do it in other ways as well. We do it by positively teaching and reinforcing what the gospel actually does say. We do it in every way we can. We do it in Sunday school. We do it in toddlers, in the Bible stories. We do it in the preparing for church class. We do it in prayer meetings. We do it in our homes, in family devotions. We do it when we put on evangelistic events. We preach the gospel, and we try and preach it as clearly as we can, because the gospel matters. Getting it right matters. Because the danger is that we assume we'll always be okay. Of course this church will be fine. Look at the history of the church. You know, 40 years now, it's stood for the truth of the gospel. It's been unmoved. Do you know what church with a far richer history than ours have started preaching a false gospel? This is a calling for every church member. We need to be on our guard. We need to make sure the gospel is believed and continue to be believed by our church. So that's the first thing, we fight together with one mind. Secondly, verse 28, we fight without being afraid. Paul says in verse 28, not in any way terrified by your adversaries. Now again, the word terrified here is a very specific word. It's used to describe horses. Have you ever seen a horse suddenly get scared and bolt and just run? I expect you have. It happens because horses get scared quite easily, actually. There's some loud noise, the horse just rears up and just runs and runs and charges off into the distance. Horses can get scared of all sorts of things. I was reading up about this. Horses can get scared of umbrellas. Horses get scared of plastic bags. Horses get scared by a door being opened suddenly. That's enough to send them bolting off into the distance. And all you can see is a cloud of dust. Once they get scared, they think, I'm off. I'm not staying here anymore. This is the opposite of when Paul says, stand firm in verse 27. Don't let anything move you or shake you. This is the opposite. Being terrified here is leg it at the first sign of anything relating to danger. Sometimes you hear stories of people who sign up to join the army, and it's so different to what they expected. And I wonder sometimes if you almost feel that as a Christian here tonight. You think, all this fighting talk, I didn't sign up for a battle when I became a Christian. I signed up because I came to love Jesus, and I came to see I needed my sins forgiven, and I put my trust in him. But all this talk of being in an army, I didn't sign up to that. Coming to love Jesus means coming to love the things he loves. We're not talking about physical warfare here. We're talking about fighting for the very message that you have come to love. The message that has saved you. The message we want others to hear as well. That's what we're fighting for, because it's worth it. Nevertheless, we can feel terrified of our adversaries. We can feel terrified of all sorts of adversaries, can't we? We can feel scared of people who have lots of letters after their name. The sort of people who say, of course, no serious scholar believes in the resurrection today. We can feel scared and intimidated by that sometimes. We can feel scared by the people who say, oh, we've all moved on from that superstitious stuff now, haven't we? We can feel intimidated by that. We feel like we want to hide. We don't want to have that conversation. We can feel scared of people at work. And think, if they knew what I believed about marriage or sexuality or about Jesus and the resurrection and him coming again and heaven and hell, we can be terrified. We just want a rock to cover us so we don't have to deal with this stuff. But I think the picture of horses can help us there again. I do think it's deliberate that he's used that image of a horse bolting and running at the first sight of danger. Because horses can be trained to not be scared of things. Horses can be trained to not be scared when they're charging into battle. You know, one of the most terrifying things that any animal can do, charging at the enemy at full speed. Horses can be trained to do that. For many of us, yeah, our default position will often be fear. We will often be scared of people who are our enemies. But we have a master who is training us, teaching us, encouraging us. And just like with horses, he does it very gently, one step at a time, day by day. So if you're a Christian, you know, you can make so much more progress than you ever thought was possible. Sometimes we look at ourselves and think, am I ever really going to change? But you can change, and you can change so much more than you imagine is possible with Christ as your mentor and your coach. And remember as well, Paul wants us to know that we're not standing alone against those enemies that we're afraid of. Have you ever been alone in the house and you hear a noise and you think, sounds like someone might be about to break in? And you're pretty scared. But have you ever been slightly reassured by the fact that your cat is there in the house with you? Even though you know full well the cat is going to do nothing to help you, it's not going to scare off an invader, it's not going to grab the phone and dial 999 with its paws, the cat will not help you at all, but you still feel reassured. You still start talking to the cat and saying, it's okay, shall we go have a look together? But we need to remember that we're not alone in the fight. But more than that, we are not each other's cats. We are not some pointless token given to each other just to make us feel a bit stronger and better. No, actually, we are part of an army. That's what you've got to remember, the picture we're given here, is an army where there is strength in unity, where there is strength, real strength, in being joined together. We're not just each other's cats, just there to make us feel a bit better. There's real strength there. Well, Paul then goes on, and he says, all this is a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that from God. What does that mean? Well, perdition is destruction. So what he's saying is this: when Christians stand fast with one mind, when Christians strive together, when Christians are not terrified of this enemy who often does scare us and make us want to bolt and run, when those things happen, it's proof that God is carrying out his program. It's proof that God is involved, giving strength to people who would otherwise bolt and run like a horse that's just seen an umbrella. It reveals that there is a real spiritual battle going on, but that God is involved. It's proof that the people who are the adversaries, the enemies, it's proof that they are headed towards destruction. But it's also proof, he says, of your salvation. Because it's evidence that God is working in them. And if God is working at them, he is going to finish that work. He is going to save them and bring them to heaven. So think back to that last time you did have some courage as a Christian. Think about that last conversation you had where someone said, well, you don't really believe that, do you? Or just said, well, what do you actually believe about that? And inwardly you took a big gulp and thought, well, I'm a bit nervous here, but I'm going to say something, and the words might come out a bit funny, but I'm going to go for it. I'm going to say something, and you did it. Think back to that last time you invited someone to a carol service or a church event or something. You said something about your faith, even though you found it scary and you were nervous doing that. Paul's saying that is evidence that God is at work in you, saving you, preparing you for glory. Thirdly, and finally then this evening, Paul says, fight knowing you may suffer. This is verses 29 and 30. Well, the army picture continues in these verses because good soldiers go into battle and they're not ignorant of what they're doing. As good as the Roman army was, it still suffered casualties. People still suffered and people were wounded and they still died in battle, that goes without saying. Verse 30, he uses this word conflict again. Well, conflict involves pain and fighting and wrestling. He says these believers in Philippi have the same conflict which you saw in me and now hear is in me. Now, Paul doesn't elaborate on what he means there, but we do know from Acts 16 some of the things that the Philippian church had seen happen to Paul. How they saw him being harangued by a demon-possessed girl, just following him everywhere he went, shouting in his ear day after day. They saw him being accused of stirring up trouble, and arrested, and beaten, put into prison. So Paul's saying here that you saw that happen, now it's happening again. You haven't witnessed it this time, firsthand, but you've heard about it. Here I am in prison in Rome again. Same thing has happened. But he also says it's been granted on behalf of Christ to these believers in Philippi, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. These Christians in Philippi have been granted the privilege of suffering for Jesus Christ. They're facing people who want to change the gospel. And they're going to have to fight tooth and nail, otherwise that good news is just going to disappear. They're facing idolatry. They're facing the power of the state and Roman rule. They're facing quarrelling church members. Paul will come on to that later on in his letter. In all sorts of ways they're facing opposition and suffering. Now, suffering in and of itself is not a privilege. No one likes suffering. We don't enjoy it, do we? But what makes a difference to our suffering is the reason you're suffering. There were so many soldiers who were ready to go out onto the battlefield and die because they died as Roman soldiers. There was honour and dignity in that, because they were dying for the Roman army, dying for the emperor, dying so that that kingdom would be advanced. It's not about the suffering, it's what you're suffering for that makes the difference. So that's why Paul says it's been granted on behalf of Christ to suffer for him. And that makes all the difference to Christian suffering. You know, so many people in this world suffer for things that are ultimately pointless. They strive to serve gods that are never satisfied because they find that they always want more money or more sexual experiences or more Instagram and YouTube followers, more prestige, more money. And they put themselves through pain and suffering to get those things. They put themselves through long hours and stress and work trying to get these things. But the suffering is all for a God that won't give them anything worthwhile at the end of it. Paul's saying here that Christian suffering is not like that. We suffer for Christ's sake. And that's how the kingdom grows and advances. We said this in previous weeks, but it is so essential to understanding the book of Philippians, in fact to the gospel itself. God's kingdom is built on the foundation of a man suffering on a cross. A man who suffers and dies. Suffering is at the very heart of salvation, and so it's so essential and integral to Christian living as well. But that suffering is never pointless. To use the army picture again, we've got a general, Jesus Christ, who doesn't just stand at the back barking orders. We have a general who led the way and stepped out in front and took the first hit. And one of the reasons he does that is to show that suffering does not mean death and defeat for anyone in this army. I don't know about you, I struggle to understand those people who were happy to die fighting for the Roman army. I guess maybe I struggle with that because I'm not living in those times. But I struggle, you know, where's the ultimate meaning in that? You're going to give your life away for an empire that just perishes and dies. But when it comes to suffering for Christ, well, there's something different altogether. Because Christ's kingdom is advancing. Our suffering is never pointless. So Paul says, remember that your citizenship is in heaven. And so he says, to go right back to the beginning, conduct yourself worthy of the gospel of Christ. That means being ready to fight for the truth, but at knowing that we're not doing that alone. We're part of a vast army of God's people. And that means nothing that happens, our suffering included, is in vain. But actually that's how the kingdom goes forward and grows. Well, we're going to close by singing, O Church, Arise.